This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Stark. I'm joined here with Brandon Adamson, and we're going to be discussing his new book, Rats of Nationalism. Brandon, great having you on.
Hey, Robert. Glad to be back.
So to start things off, you make an interesting analogy between this book is primarily about dissident political scenes, and you make an analogy to the game Candyland, where there's this kind of illusion that you're participating, but basically everything in Candyland's a matter of pure luck, and you're not at all in control of your destiny.
Yeah, you're basically in the game Candyland, which was Pill Eater actually made a video about this game, which reactivated my nostalgia for this game from when I played it in the 80s. But basically, you're there's an illusion that you're making decisions, but you're not really. It's all entirely just the chance of the card and the deck of it. And I kind of related a little bit to these political dissident communities and nationalism and the alt-right, where people are kind of under the impression that that they're going along with certain ideas and memes and so forth, but they're really not making these decisions. They're being like pushed in a certain direction, and they're being distracted by the fun of all these memes, which are basically like the equivalent of like candy. You know, the Candyland board is very aesthetically pleasing. You know, it's really, if you ever look at the game board of Candyland, you're like, wow, this is amazing, right? But you're not actually making decisions in the game or anything. Like, you're not really even doing anything.
The thing is, you've never really been into conspiracy theories. How relevant is the topic of conspiracy theories to this book? And most of this, it's not based on conspiracy theories, but rather first-hand experiences that you've had, especially on social media.
Well, and I also I also make clear when I'm speculating, which is something that most conspiracy theorists don't do. They just say like, "Hey, this is what's going on." Whereas in my case, I've never really been into conspiracy theories. Like, I was never into like a 9/11 truth or the Illuminati or even JFK assassination. The Sandy Hook, all Alex Jones, like, I never was into any of that crap. That's not to say that there can't possibly be anything to those theories. It's just it was never something that I was interested in. And my problem with most conspiracy theorists is that if you've ever talked to them, like, they believe every conspiracy theory, basically. Every new event that happens is some kind of a false flag or something like that. So it's not like they just pick something and they're like, oh, this is interesting. There may be something here. It's like they automatically go straight to that whenever you talk about any of these things. And I would not have written about my speculation on Fed infiltration of the alt-right and these political dissident movements if I didn't have a little bit of first-hand experience, which I don't really want to go into. But let's just say if you've been on social media in these movements for as long a time as I have, then you can, if you're just by observing, you can pick up on certain patterns, and social media really does allow for that to happen. And that's basically where I'm coming from.
There's this whole theme of Fed infiltration of dissident movements. What is people's general conception of Fed infiltration, and how accurate is it, and what's mistaken or incomplete?
Well, I think a lot of people are very, very naive, and they have this this conception of a Fed as someone who basically LARPs as like a hardcore neo-Nazi and promotes violence, and you know the quote, you know, the Fed posting, and just basically tries to say outlandish quotes and tries to make a movement look crazy or violent and stupid, and tries to basically entrap people into incriminating themselves. And like that type of Fed, like it totally exists, and there are plenty of documented cases of that, one of which I even point out in the book. But
are you talking about the guy who
in Oklahoma, right? That one, where he basically this kid is basically mentally ill, and this Fed informant really just kind of like almost bosses him into incriminating himself and going along with the Seward's.
That's happened countless times.
Yeah, exactly. Where the person doesn't even seem like they're interested in committing a violent act, but this other person coaxes them into going along with it, and then suddenly they're busted. So yeah, there are plenty of cases of that happening. But really, the point of the book, though, is to get people to see that, well, there are other kinds of Feds that are manipulating you that are people that you wouldn't necessarily suspect.
So not so much, you're not talking about like the examples of incitement to violence or criminal behavior, or the really outlandish, kooky stuff, or really extreme stuff, or far-out stuff. You're talking more about creating like an invisible glass ceiling that prevents any organization from having any influence whatsoever.
Well, there's also just rather than like a Fed who enters into the equation, like when some guy is kind of crazy and, you know, 20 minutes before he's ready to commit some kind of terrorist attack or like a shooting or something, there are Feds that insert themselves into the scene like earlier on in the radicalization process with an attempt to de-radicalize people and pacify them and just kind of nudge them in a different direction.
Oh, so put them in a more like a more moderate or nonviolent direction, because that actually kind of goes against the general conspiracy theory angle that basically these government agents are always trying to incite violence. So that actually, what you're saying actually goes, obviously narratives, like all those narratives are there's always, you can't really rely upon a simplistic narrative, but it does counteract that.
Yeah, well, and keep in mind that, you know, it's actually better for them to infiltrate these movements and move people in a healthier in a direction that's less hostile toward the United States.
Oh, so you were giving an example of some federal agents on I think it was either 4chan or 8chan, which were saying like these conspiracy theories, instead of linking them to the United States or Israel, trying to like create a conspiracy theory that Russia is behind a lot of different things.
Yeah, exactly. So the guy who was caught, the Fed who was caught posting on 8chan or one of these sites, he wasn't doing, quote, Fed posting, you know, trying to gin up violence or whatever. He was trying to nudge these people that were angry. He wanted to kind of redirect their anger towards towards some other country. You know, so he wasn't doing the thing that people typically do. And so there are people who present themselves not as like hardcore neo-Nazi types, but of people who you wouldn't suspect that, or maybe they're just like funny accounts with like a cartoon avatar or something that just make jokes, or people that present as very reasonable and well-spoken people those people can attract huge followings.
I noticed in the book that you avoid making specific allegations against different dissident figures, like accusing them of being a Fed, because that happens a lot, but you avoid doing that without any kind of solid evidence.
Well, you have to be careful, because once you start going around like just accusing people of being Feds, like, then you very quickly become that guy, you know, like so many of these. I know you've been around this stuff a long time, so like so many of those old like cranks on forums, like those grouchy that accuse everyone of being, every new person of being like controlled opposition or a shill or so forth. So I don't think that it's even really useful to do that. I mean, there are a couple people that I know with relative certainty actually are Feds, but I don't have any documented evidence for that. And even if I did, it's still useless to really accuse them, because, I mean, even with that, people are going to believe what they want to believe. And I think that it's important. What's really important is for people to improve their perception and their intuition, because that's what's going to carry you forward. And I think that even just by going around accusing people of being Feds, and I think that is the sort of thing that is actually something that the Feds are promoting right now. If you look online, you see just a flood of all of these different back and forth accusations between various people, and the Feds just have to be absolutely loving that. And I mentioned this also toward the end of the book, as I say, like, the Feds have already preempted this stuff by creating this meme of ironically identifying as a Fed. So if you look through all of these like different Groiper accounts and just these shit posting accounts on Twitter, like, there's, you could see like 20 or 30% of them now have like Fed in their bio, you know, mixed in,
oh, right,
incorporated into their username. So I know that you've seen it, because you're
The thing is, there's this proliferation of all these different memes and ideas. So to what degree, like, are they not entirely organic?
Well, we don't know for sure, but I give a couple of examples of things, like, for example, the astroturfing for Andrew Yang. I think that was something that was being pushed by some group, probably the Feds, as an attempt to de-radicalize former people in the alt-right by getting them into these memes again, but memes which are kind of consequence-free in that they're like pushing people back into the electoral process, all of these like black-pilled former alt-right people.
Well, you were basically, kind of, you were sort of one of those people. You did support Yang, because for Yang gives you a degree of respectability, and a lot of these people, political dissidents on the dissident right, were socially ostracized. They lost friends and family who cut off ties from them. A lot of them lost their jobs, so supporting Yang gives you an opportunity to be part of respectable society, and you can basically tell someone that, yeah, I'm for Andrew Yang, and there's no social backlash. You did say you got disappointed with Yang, as a lot of people in the dissident sphere did. Did you? We didn't get a chance to talk about this, but at some point, didn't you write an article that was a follow-up to that?
Yeah, I did, and a lot of it was just Yang himself. He went in a completely different direction than he could have gone in. So rather than kind of court these political dissidents, he just kind of maneuvered back towards like a basic bitch, like social justice warrior, liberal. He didn't even go in the direction like Tulsi Gabbard went. He just went, like, I think in his first appearance in the debate, like, he barely talked at all, but what he did, like, he just, like, went on about the Russian interference bullshit.
So, like, basically a standard liberal Democrat combined with a UBI?
Yeah, and just, he just went in a completely different direction than he could have gone. Like, he should have been, So in a way, that meme experiment or whatever was being pushed, it was actually kind of cut short by Yang himself. But he just instead of just sticking with the UBI and maybe like just being less anti-white than some of the other Democrats, like that's really all he needed to do. But instead, he did this thing where he had to come up with a new policy every day, and some of them were just so fucking bonkers that, like, it just, there was no way that, you know, like lowering the voting age to 15 or something, like 16 or something, just things that, like, we were just going to lose so much of these supporters that that were black-pilled and that were just looking for some kind of pathway back into respectable society and electoral politics.
How easily programmable do you think people are?
Well, one thing I mentioned in the book is that I believe that a lot of people signal how programmable they are by how much they incorporate the latest memes into their persona or their internet content. If you look at so many people's profiles, like their personas are entirely constructed around whatever the latest memes are. And I think that that's a signal to me that that person is very programmable. Because what happens is that they can, even if it's just these like emojis and lingo and things like that, just by adopting these things, that it sets them up later for the people who push these memes. It sets these people up for being programmed in other ways ideologically, because they've already been primed to take their cues from these influencers that push these things. So then when someone wants to seed something political or something else, they're already primed and ready to go to ride on the next train.
Are PSYOP motivations sometimes counterintuitive?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is another area, I think, where that goes back to these misconceptions about feds and what their motivations are. Something like, I believe that various figures and ideas are boosted and taken down as a way of maintaining balance in the, so they'll boost some alt-right political figure for a while, and then when he gets a little too big, then they got to take him down a notch, and then, you know, they'll boost something like Antifa, and then when that gets a little out of hand, then you'll start to see articles like, we've got to rein in Antifa. They're getting to be too much of a nuisance. And so I believe that it's this constant balance. An example of how PSYOP motivations can be counterintuitive is the one I give in the book, which is about modern art. So if you'll notice that,
because the thing is, you, I mean, unlike a lot of those dissident right types, you actually like modern art.
Well, not, I mean, not all of it, but I mean, I actually studied art history, and so I do, I don't know, I understand certain things about it. Like most conservatives just really just don't know anything about art. They don't even think it's like worthwhile to study. So they don't know anything really about art history. But it was revealed that this is legit. This was actually revealed that in the 1950s that that the U.S. government promoted modern art among the general population and supported it financially. And so most people in the dissident right, they came to this this conclusion because they you know, they naturally would, but they were just like, see, like, no one really likes modern art. This was just a psyop by the CIA to I guess basically just to I don't know, to torture people or something by promoting this stuff. But no, actually, the reason why they promoted it, that why the CIA boosted modern art, was because they thought that it would make the U.S. appear more open and more artistically and intellectually free than the Soviet Union. So they promoted it because they thought by doing so it would make the U.S. look good. So not because they wanted to torture the citizens. And I also point out that and that was relatively like at the end of modern art, because really modern art originated with the invention of the camera. Because once the camera was invented, you suddenly had this technology that could duplicate an image perfectly. So it changed the function of art, and so people started wondering, like, well, what can painting do? What can art do that that a camera can't do? So that was part of it, and but that doesn't necessarily mean that everything that came out of that development was necessarily good or that I like. It's just a fact. I mean, by 1950, it was kind of like it was already getting towards the end.
Or there was postmodernism with Jackson Pollock and Andy Warhol.
Yeah, and I mean, you can get into all that stuff later, but the idea that people in the alt-right have this idea that modern art was created, quote, created as a psyop. That's not true. It was simply boosted towards the end of its lifespan, and boosted because they thought it would make the United States look good compared to the Soviet Union. And as I point out in the book, some of the most famous works of modern art occurred in Russia in the early 20th century, prior to the Soviet Union. So so actually back during the time that before communism, that these people want to go back to. So
there's various film references in the book, including Secret of Nim, which did serve as a partial inspiration for the book. So what are the significance of the different film references?
Well, the significance of the Secret of Nim was when I was a kid, I was really obsessed with the movie The Secret of Nim when I saw it, and I actually went out in the front yard and constructed this with toys in the bushes, like a habitat for these rats to live, because Secret of Nim deals with the story of these rats that are done experiments on, and mice by the government, and the experiments end up making the rats and mice more intelligent, and so they escape and they form their own kind of advanced rat civilization in this rose bush. So I had constructed this habitat for them out in the bushes, but there were no rats where I lived. There was nothing like that. So But it served as an inspiration because you have these people that are in these dissident movements that they don't really even understand. They're not really even aware that they're being done these kinds of social experiments on, and they're being prodded and pushed in these various directions, and that they're being basically experimented with, and they don't realize this. And once they do, and you become a little bit more wise to it, more intelligent, then I don't know, you kind of see that these dissidents are really kind of off on their own. You know, they're not like they're not like normal rats anymore, right? So they have to go live in their own place, and that's a lot what being a political dissident is like. You know, quote, I hate to use this term, red pilled, is actually like. And the other film references in the book, what I think they all have in common, basically, is you have individuals trying to parse their way through what is a counterfeit reality that, you know, that they're trying to navigate through. And that's with an example is the film Rollerball from the 1970s, and even other films like Fathom and To Live and Die in L.A., which deals with how the feds and how morally there's very little to distinguish between the feds and the police and criminals, really, how they use the same lingo, and they have the kind of same, they kind of walk on the same line.
How are girls being used for various purposes against political dissidents?
Well, I believe that girls can be used for a couple different reasons. I mean, there's no shortage of, troubled girls that are found online, and I believe that a lot of the feds have ways of pushing people and socially engineering people into getting involved with one another. And I think they do this for various purposes. They can be using a girl to get close to someone, to get information, to disrupt their life, either just for psychological torture or something like that. Or they can also use it as a means of de-radicalization, because someone who is kind of like a loner and single and pissed off, like, you know, what's a better way to pacify that dude than to get him involved in a relationship? So I think if they see that, oh, this guy is has taken an interest in this girl, let's try to push them together. So I think that they're used for various purposes, and to what extent these girls are actually in on it, I really don't know. I think that some of them may actually be agents themselves, whereas other ones are just kind of ones that somehow got roped into this stuff just by being pushed into it, being online in the wrong place at the wrong time, and being noticed by someone.
What are some of the problems with anonymity?
Well, I think that a big problem with anonymity is that the opponents have adapted, and they've found ways to obviously use it against this. So, I mean, anonymity is useful because you can talk about ideas without being fired, or you can be honest and open about ideas. But the problem with anonymity is that you can't scrutinize anyone's background that you're dealing with, so the barrier to entry is very low. So basically anyone, a Fed or just anyone who has any intent, you don't have any idea what their intentions are. They can, all they need to do is go on 8chan and start posting like they're part of your movement, or they can go on Twitter and make an account with a Groiper avatar or just some kind of old European statue, and suddenly they're part of the alt-right and they're posting, and you don't know what their intentions are. They can pivot, they can say anything, they can make you look bad, and you just don't know who you're dealing with. And there have been so many cases where people have presented themselves online one way, and after they were doxxed or whatever, it turned out that this was a completely different person. You have people that pretend to be trad wives that turned out to be like transgender and things like that. I mean, even not dealing with infiltration, that's still, you're still dealing with all kinds of problems. But I don't recommend that people get rid of anonymity necessarily or dox themselves, because I don't think that most people are mentally prepared for that. And I think that anyone who does suggest that you do that should probably be viewed with suspicion, because you shouldn't push someone to not be anonymous. They have to make that decision if they want to live with the consequences of that. But I think that anonymity is definitely, in some ways, it has outlived its usefulness, because it can just as easily be used back against you.
And you mentioned in the book that you see yourself more as an artist and a writer, but that you never really got interested in activism.
No, I mean, I've never been the type to go to events. I've never been to a single one of these events. Never went to Charlottesville or any of these, any NPI, any of those. I always just thought that going to these was kind of a bad idea, because if someone attacks you there and even you defend yourself, like, you're not going to get a fair shake in court. And I think people realize that now, but to me, it's just it just wasn't worth it for me. But some people, I guess, thrive in that kind of environment, but I'm not that kind of person, man. I'm the quiet writer type, not like the kind of dress up in like Walmart armor and just go brawl in the streets. That's just it's not me, man. If that's your bag, then I don't mean to disparage activist types. Like, if everyone has a different role to play.
And also, the thing is, for people who follow the show that we've done know this, but for people listening now, it's important to point out that you've never really identified strongly with the dissident right. You've always kind of went off and did your own thing, and your side even was called alt-left. It still is, but you're sort of, I guess some people are calling it the alt-center sphere. It's kind of hard to like pick one label. But you've always been kind of politically homeless.
Yeah, and I mean, I've stopped caring as much about these kinds of labels, because things have gotten so crazy now that, I mean, even the most mild people are basically lumped in with hardcore Nazis and things like that. So I don't bother as much anymore making these kinds of esoteric ideological distinctions, even though we have these differences. Like, I'm honestly much more interested in people who are real, and than I am in some of these I don't know, these ideological differences and stuff that we had so many shows like fighting with people about. I think that I get so excited if someone is even like genuine, like a genuine political dissident, and they're not there to disrupt anything. They're not a shill. They're not a fake. Like, I'm just like, wow, you're real. Like, I'm cool. I don't even care what you believe.
there's all these different memes, like the red pill, and then there's also the black pill. And blue pill is, that's a meme to describe people who embrace the more kind of like mainstream liberal views. The thing is, you're actually saying, as far as the symbolism goes of the color blue, that you identify more with blue than the red pill.
Yeah, because, I mean, number one, I never, I've mentioned this before, but I never liked the pill analogy because I always hated the movie The Matrix. I always thought it was like, yeah, I remember when it came out, like I totally hated it because it was all about like stupid effects and just this melodramatic thing, like, is, you know, he's the one and that kind of stuff. I remember thinking that it was just like just totally cornball, and that's coming from me, like somebody who likes like 70s sci-fi, that I thought The Matrix was cornier than any of that stuff. And I identify more, I think, with the color blue, because traditionally blue represents sincerity and intuition and dreams and all of these different things, whereas I associate the color red more with like just like anger and this fiery and just,
well, psychologically,
like,
If you have a lot of red in your house, like, it's proven to increase levels of anxiety, while blue tends to have a calming effect. So I don't know how relevant it is to that.
Sure. I mean, blue, I think, is more of an intuitive and a kind of contemplative, and it represents like sincerity, I think, and love. Whereas I think red just kind of represents this kind of like, just dumb, like people who are ruled by anger, I don't associate it with something that's with intelligence, I guess.
And the overall message that people can get out of this book is that the importance in being sincere and real.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, I just see these people all day long that just continuously get swept up in these memes and just being pushed and nudged in various directions. And really, I think that what the book is really about is just to improve your own perception and intuition. And it's seriously, it's okay to be sincere. It's okay to be real. You don't need to get pushed into all of this like irony nonsense, you know, because that is what is going to bring you this social media clout. It's okay to be sincere. It's okay to express genuine emotion, like, and everything doesn't have to be this kind of this show, like. And I think by just trying to be sincere and trying as hard as you can, like, no one can really think for themselves because we're bombarded with so much stuff that no one is really like a free thinker, you know, despite what they think. But I think that by increasing your perception and your awareness and resisting the temptation to go along with every new figure that's being boosted and every idea that's being promoted and every new meme and responding to every planted news story, that you can try to break out of this framework, right? You can break out of Candyland and just be real.
And do you want to plug your book, Rats of Nationalism? And for people who want to find it, they can buy it on, purchase it on Amazon.
Yeah. So, I mean, I recommend that you purchase the book, The Rats of Nationalism. It's available on Amazon. And yeah, just buy it. I'm not the kind of person who's looking to make a bunch of money. I'm not like a quote grifter, to use one of the latest terms that you shouldn't be using.
Well, what's inherently bad about making, because grifter, being a grifter is a big, it's a big meme right now, and it's usually used to describe either, like, it's often used to describe, like, the alt-right, or the more, kind of, like, more generic, like, conservative activists. The thing is, like, what's inherently bad about trying to make a living off of activism, as long, or just, like, your political or cultural endeavors, as long as you're putting out a good product, because it gives people a way to sort of, if they can't support themselves in a more traditional job. So I don't really see how that's inherently bad or being a grifter, as long as you're putting out a good product.
Yeah, as long as it's a genuine product. But it's also, you know, another thing is that a lot of these people, they don't have the courage. They're not willing to even speak their opinions in public. So if I'm out there, if I'm putting myself out there, and I'm laying it on the line for you, like, I've sacrificed, you know, my ability to have some kind of corporate career. So do that, which I don't think you necessarily that you should, because, you know, not everyone should be giving this commentary, but, you know, these people still have to make a living, you know, so you should at least support them if they're real, if they're genuine and they have the passion, you know, behind it. So I think that the term grifter, I think, is just another one of these words that's pushed and circulated, that really, if you're using this word every day, grifter, or you know, just like one of a thousand other words, that these are people that are just, they're programmed, you know, they're programmed to say whatever the latest shit is, like, just snap out of it.
Brandon Adamson, it's been an excellent show. Check out our Rats of Nationalism.
Thanks, Robert.